current state three times daily here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Everything that we do on Current State is always, it always ends up, all of it, on our website, wkar.org. Click on radio and then click on Current State. Hear us live every weekday morning at 9, and we replay the program at 6 p.m. here on 90.5 FM. They basically botched it. That's how Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette described the actions of two engineering firms who were working on Flint water before and after the city's ill-fated switch to the Flint River in 2014. Yesterday, the Attorney General announced civil actions against the two firms, Veolia and LAN, seeking hundreds of millions of dollars. To help us understand more about the latest legal action, Current State welcomes two guests on the phone. Mr. Noah Hall is a special assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. He's also an environmental and water law expert from Wayne State University. Mr. Hall, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Osting reported on this development yesterday for the Detroit News. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
I thought before we got into the allegations against these two firms, I thought we'd just try to set up a little bit of context here. Mr. Hall, can you tell us what these two companies were doing in Flint? What work were they doing?
Sure. That's a great place to start. The first company, LAN, Lockwood, an engineering firm based out of Texas and Nebraska, has been doing work in Flint since 2011. They were hired by the city of Flint back in 2011 to study whether the Flint River could be a safe water supply for the residents, and if so, what they would need to do with the Flint water treatment plant in order to deliver safe water from the Flint River. City of Flint relied on that advice and that analysis, and then in 2013, hired the same company, LAN, to upgrade and update their water treatment plant, which hadn't really been used for daily use for over 50 years, and get it ready to deliver safe water from the Flint River. So that first company, LAN, was basically the engineering firm that came in and designed the updates and the improvements to the Flint water treatment plant so that it could use Flint River water. Of course, they failed to add corrosion control and other safety measures, which we could get into later. The second company, Veolia, which is the world's largest water services company, they do business in dozens of countries in every state. They got hired by Flint in late January, early February of 2015, after Flint had already switched to the Flint River, and the residents were seeing terrible problems with their water, not just brown and discolored water, odor, taste, numerous reported violations of the Safe Drinking Water Act for E. coli and other pathogens, and some fairly major warning signs from the General Motors factory that they had to stop using Flint River water because it was corroding their engine parts. So with all of these problems going on and the residents very upset, very concerned, demanding action, demanding answers, the city hired Veolia in January 2015, actually put them under contract in February of 2015, and Veolia was hired to come in and figure out if there's a problem with the water, if so, what the cause is, and what needs to be done about it, and ultimately to let the residents know if the water was safe or what needed to be done to make the water safe. So Veolia came in, that was in the spring of 2015, late winter of 2015. They came in and they told the residents, basically, your water is safe. The discoloration in the brown water is nothing to worry about. Keep drinking it.
Noah, this is Jonathan from the news. On that point, these companies are both charged with negligence, but also in the case of Veolia, fraud, actually, or accused of fraud in the civil case. Can you explain, the origin of those claims, specifically the fraud one I'm curious about?
Sure. And they're actually pretty straightforward claims. I mean, these are the types of claims that you would have against a contractor that comes and does work on your house and does a bad job. Basically, the first claim is professional negligence, which is also known as malpractice. Folks are usually most familiar with this claim when it comes up against a doctor for failing to diagnose your illness or using the wrong type of treatment and causing you further harm. But professional negligence malpractice applies to any profession. Attorneys are subject to it, and professional engineers. And so our first claim is just as a matter of professional standards and professional duties, these engineering firms, who are licensed engineers within their profession, came in and did work that's simply not up to the standard of a professional engineer. They did poor work, negligent work. The second claim, which is just made against Veolia, is fraud. Fraud, quite simply put, is when somebody gives you bad information, knowing that you're going to rely on that bad information and ultimately doing you harm with that bad information. That's exactly what happened here. Veolia told the residents the water was safe. Veolia told the residents the cause of the brown water was merely old rusty pipes or a water main break. Veolia said there was no reason for further concern, no health concerns, no fundamental, never mentioned corrosion and what it could do in terms of lead. And they gave that information very publicly. They showed up at a Flint City Council meeting, gave a PowerPoint presentation, and essentially sold the residents on the idea that their water was safe, or at least tried to sell the residents on the idea that their water was safe.
Was that the same day? Was that the PowerPoint presentation I read about that happened on the same day that we learned more about the water of Leanne Walters in Flint?
Exactly. You've got your date spot on. That's exactly correct. It was February 18th, 2015. Veolia gave a PowerPoint presentation to the Flint City Council with a lot of members of the public present, told them their water was safe, never mentioned lead, and that very same day, Mike Glasgow from the city of Flint went out and tested the water of Leanne Walters, and it came back at 104 parts per billion of lead. Just to give you some idea, anything over about 5 parts per billion of lead, you're going to be concerned, especially if it's your kids. Anything over 15 parts per billion of lead, the drinking water supply needs to take some corrective measures and get people an alternative supply of safe water. At 104 parts per billion of lead, a resident drinking that water is facing an immediate health threat. And Leanne Walters had 2 young children in her home at the time that Veolia told her the water was safe. The very same day, the test showed that she had 104 parts per billion of lead.
Noah, we know from emails that around that same time, an EPA regulator started looking at this issue, raising it with the DEQ, asking why the state hadn't required corrosion controls in the water. And that's where a lot of the blame has been placed heretofore, is on the state government for not requiring these corrosion control chemicals, perhaps due to a misinterpretation of federal law. So the Attorney General's office has charged 2 MDEQ employees in the criminal investigation. How are you able to square those two, that the MDEQ has responsibility, but these companies also have responsibility? And some critics are saying that the AG's office is trying to shift blame here away from the state. Is that I assume you disagree with that characterization. Why?
Well, it's a great question, and actually I'm really happy to chat about that and kind of get into the details. What happened in Flint is a series of events with, frankly, plenty of blame to go around. It's not like there was one decision made at one point in time that caused all of these harms and injuries in the whole Flint water crisis. What happened were some criminal actions. As our office has charged 2 state officials already and reached a deal with a third, of course, local official, there was absolutely some criminal actions involved here. There was also some negligent and fraudulent actions by companies, and the two worked hand in hand. In effect, the state officials committed misconduct by failing to require corrosion control and otherwise violating the Safe Drinking Water Act, Veolia was brought in to figure out what was wrong with the water, and Veolia essentially covered up the conduct of the state officials and then made it worse. Further, it's not like Veolia or LAN was an innocent bystander or even just a concerned citizen seeing this happen. Veolia and LAN were professional companies hired, paid tens of thousands of dollars, in the case of LAN, hundreds of thousands of dollars, for their professional expertise, advice, judgment, and problem solving. And they didn't do that work. It no way lets the state officials off the hook for their criminal actions, but Veolia's fraudulent statements induced the residents to continue to believe the water was safe for months and months after we knew that was no longer true. So there's clearly points in time at which the negligence of these companies became a big factor in why the Flint water crisis blew up to the scale it did.
Noah Hall is a special assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News also joins us here this morning. We're talking about events related to yesterday's civil actions launched by the state of Michigan against two engineering firms who were working on Flint water before and after the switch to the Flint River in 2014. We'll point out that both LAN and Veolia issued pretty vigorous statements defending themselves. LAN's comments, the Flint Water Advisory Task Force found that this tragedy was a story of government failure at all levels. We're surprised and disappointed that the state would change direction and wrongfully accuse LAN of acting improperly. Veolia claiming that its engagement with the city was wholly unrelated to the lead issues. It says, in fact, lead and copper testing were specifically not included in the company's scope of work because the city represented that it was itself conducting required testing at the time of our analysis. Would you care to respond to those rebuttals, Noah?
Sure. Very specifically, first of all, the state task force report, which, by the way, I think is an excellent piece of work and has been very useful for not just the public but our office. The state task force report did not discuss LAN very much. That's absolutely correct. Of course, LAN doesn't mention why. The reason, and this is written right into the state task force report, is that LAN did not cooperate with the state task force report. The state task force report says that they tried contacting LAN numerous times with questions and requests for documents, and they were basically ignored. And the state task force report actually includes, I believe, as an appendix to the back of that report, a list of the questions that they had for LAN that LAN never answered before the report went out. So for LAN to say that they were somehow cleared by the state task force report is a total mischaracterization. They essentially refused to cooperate with the state task force report, and the state task force report made very clear that an issue of future investigation should be the role of LAN and the competence of LAN in the work they did for Flint. Secondly, on Veolia's point, Veolia is trying to get a little, I think, too cute with the technicalities here. First of all, Veolia, and this is all public, all publicly reported. You can go and look at Veolia's statements by their vice presidents to the public and to the media back in February of 2015. Veolia told the public in 2015 that they were going to take a comprehensive look at the entire water system in Flint, from the intake of water at the Flint River to how the water comes out of people's taps, that they were going to take a comprehensive look at the entire system, figure out what was going on, what problems were existing, what needed to be done about it, and whether the water was safe for residents. Now, of course, they're coming back and saying, "Oh, we only did a small job. We didn't take on the whole project." But of course, that's not true.
No. We're just about out of time. I'm going to let Jonathan ask the last question here. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Sure. Let me go back to LAN real quick. Their response specifically, they said that they regularly advised that corrosion control should be added, and that it was the decision of the city and the state not to do so. I know, Noah, you based a lot of your claims on publicly available documents. Did you see anything to that effect in those documents, or do you have any reason to believe they're not being truthful there when they say they did bring up corrosion control with the city and state?
Well, frankly, that's an issue that we're going to have to learn more about in discovery. But at some level, it doesn't matter. Think about it this way. If the city hired land to build a bridge, and they told land not to use middle supports for the bridge, and land said, oh, we don't think that's a good idea. We need these supports or the bridge might collapse. And the city says, no, go ahead and build the bridge without the supports. So land builds the bridge without the supports. The bridge collapses. Absolutely, the city would be to blame in that circumstance, but so would land. Land is the professional engineer. They get hired for their expertise, and at some level, regardless of what their client asks them to do, they have a duty to do work that is safe and competent for the public, and they failed that duty.
Sure. All right. Well, thanks so much, Noah, for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I tell you what, we've got a few more minutes here. We're going to continue this conversation. This is going rather well, and we appreciate Mr. Hall being with us here. Have you been able to contact the engineering firms or their legal representatives? I mean, do you know who's representing them?
At this time, I've had no contact with the firms or their attorneys, and that's pretty standard in a civil case. We've essentially fired the first shot, the complaint, and now we'll have a chance to begin a discussion with the attorneys, with the engineering firms, and see where they want to go from here. It's a little bit of a tricky situation because we've got a criminal investigation going, and we've been very careful not to use any of our powers or any of the information we've obtained through our criminal investigation in developing this civil lawsuit against the companies. So at some level, we're starting from day one. Yesterday was day one. We file our complaint. Now the ball is in the company's court, and I expect, frankly, I expect them to, hire a team of lawyers and attempt to defend their reputation. Veolia, in particular, is the subject of a lot of litigation around the country. Veolia has a pretty mixed track record of doing business with cities. Oftentimes, there's claims of breach of contract, fraud, negligence. There's been some corruption scandals with Veolia. So Veolia knows how to hire lawyers and knows how to defend themselves, and we're looking forward to making our case in court.
Sure. Well, on that note, how long do you anticipate something like this could take? There are, of course, lots of civil lawsuits out there right now involving the Flint water crisis, several class action suits filed on behalf of Flint residents. Those also tend to name the state government as well, though. Is it easier to go after companies than it is the government for something like this, especially when you're looking for damages?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, the standard for going after a company is a little different than going after government, especially when you're dealing with professional negligence here. You know, and this goes back to the really big issue about who's to blame for the Flint water crisis, government or the companies. And it's not either or. What happened in Flint is just one example of this growing trend of public-private partnerships, where government relies heavily on private companies for their expertise and the services they provide. And there's nothing wrong with public-private partnerships. Sometimes they could be a very efficient way of giving citizens better services. But when the public-private partnership fails, which it very much did in Flint, both the public entities need to be held responsible and the private companies need to be held responsible. If a partnership fails to deliver for the residents and the citizens, both partners in the partnership should ultimately be held accountable in court.
We're talking with Noah Hall, Special Assistant Attorney General for the State of Michigan. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News also joins me here on WKAR's Current State. We are talking about issues related to the civil action that was announced yesterday, by the Office of Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette. Todd Flood, as we pointed out, is working on the criminal side of this for the AG's office. Jonathan, I want to direct a question to you. Your reporting seems to suggest that he's encountering some hurdles. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. He's mentioned roadblocks before from government agencies, and he said yesterday that that is essentially continuing, that he is not getting all of the documents he requested. Now, documents can mean emails, it can mean text messages, it can mean voicemails, even PowerPoints, he said. And the reporters pressed him pretty hard on that, trying to figure out, well, what agencies are withholding documents? And he wouldn't say. And what is the government, is the governor withholding documents? He wouldn't say, but he did say very emphatically that he's not getting everything he needs and that all agencies, including the governor, will eventually turn over documents if he forces them hard enough. So he's obviously trying to put pressure on whoever it is, trying to poke whoever it is that's not turning over documents. It's sort of a weird situation here for the Attorney General's office because they have assistants Attorney General that are actually working for some state agencies that are involved in some of this document retrieval. But Bill Schuette, Attorney General, has created what he calls a firewall in his office where the investigation is completely separate. So it's theoretical that people who work for the Attorney General are not producing all the documents that the Attorney General's investigation is looking for. However, in the case of the governor's office, he's also hired outside counsel that is involved in that process as well that could potentially be playing a role. We don't know because Todd Flood was not willing to get into specifics.
Noah Hall, care to comment on any of that?
No, I'm going to leave the criminal investigation to my partner, Todd. I would just say that I certainly wouldn't want to be in Todd Flood's crosshairs, and not cooperating with Todd Flood is going to make your week and your month pretty miserable.
Jonathan, one more question for you here, and I'll actually direct this at both of you. On a possibly related note, there was another drop of internal Flint emails just a few days ago from the governor's office, if I'm not mistaken. Are we learning more from that? Are you going through emails? What's in there?
We are. It's been a busy news week, obviously, and there were 300,000 pages of emails released this week. So to be honest, I've been tied up on a lot of other stuff. We have some other reporters on our team that are looking through those. These email dumps from the governor are, of course, always welcome, but they also tend to be a little repetitive. So you're seeing a lot of emails that you've seen before, but maybe a different part of the thread in that email conversation. But there are some from some agencies that we haven't seen before that could be very telling. It's just a matter of sifting through all of those.
Noah Hall, Attorney General Schuette referred again yesterday to more charges to come. What do you think lay ahead here?
Well, we're being fairly systematic in this entire investigation. Much like the media and much like the public, we're learning more every day. And every bit that we learn is putting another piece together in the puzzle. As we learn enough to essentially to have a strong legal case against any of the actors, we bring the case. And then as things develop, you learn more and more. There's also a little bit of a pattern or process here where we go after the folks for whom the evidence is the strongest right up front, and then in the course of our investigation of those folks or those companies, we learn more about other people involved and other companies involved. You brought up one example earlier. Lan is saying that they were directed not to use corrosion control by various officials. We're going to learn more about that allegation in the course of this litigation, and it could give rise to additional charges.
We want to thank both of our guests here. Noah Hall is a Special Assistant Attorney General for the state of Michigan. He's also an environmental and water law expert from Wayne State University. Are you on loan from Wayne State, Mr. Hall? Is that how this works?
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's really honestly an honor to be a teacher at a public university, and then when the state needs me to do instead of teach, as they say, I'm very happy to do so. So I took a leave from Wayne State for the rest of this year so I can focus on this work for Flint, which is the most important work I've done with my career.
We want to thank you for joining us. We hope to have you back. Also, a big thank you to Jonathan Osting for his contribution here to this segment today. He reports for the Detroit News. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, we'll get that down-home feeling as the 21st annual Junegrass Bluegrass Festival gets underway at the Kent County Fairgrounds this weekend in Lowell. We'll have a report coming up on Current State. Forget 1 week from tonight, or I misspoke. It is next Wednesday. It's the next edition of Current State's pop-up stories here at the Allen Marketplace. Our theme is putting down roots. If you have always wanted to get up and tell a story on that theme or loosely related to that theme, this is your opportunity. 5:30 to 7 next Wednesday night at the Allen Marketplace. More on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. 2 days ago, Governor Rick Snyder signed into law a measure to rescue the Detroit public schools from insolvency and plot a new course for the district. The highly debated $617 million package will help launch a new debt-free school district. The DPS currently educates 46,000 students. The governor said the legislation marked a new day for Detroit, but it sharply divided the state legislature. It became law without the support of any Democrat in the legislature. Critics fear it won't solve the district's funding challenges and will create others. Our next guest spent much of Wednesday in meetings discussing plans for the new Detroit public school system. To learn more, we welcome State School Superintendent Brian Whiston. Welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
You spent much of the day yesterday, I'm told, in meetings that included Judge Stephen Rhodes, the emergency manager for DPS, as well as State Treasurer Nick Curry and members of the governor's staff discussing the new DPS. What can you tell us about the discussions?
Well, we have had ongoing discussions about, how do we transform from the old district to the new district, the new community district, and there's a lot of paperwork required, a lot of, opening of new checking accounts and transferring over current contracts and grants and student data files, and so we've been working jointly between the district, the Department of Education, the Department of Treasury to make sure that Detroit has a smooth, rebirth here of the new community district. So there's a lot of work to be done as that district gets created as of July 1. And so we were just coordinating our efforts to make sure it goes smoothly. And then we also began the conversation about what do we do academically to help Detroit turn around its performance and test scores. A lot of great things going on in Detroit, in the schools, in the community. And we just want to make sure we're helping to create, a world-class district as we get to this new opportunity, this kind of historic opportunity to get a fresh start.
It does appear to be an opportunity at a fresh start. Regrettably, a report was just released Tuesday from the Annie E. Casey Foundation ranking the state 40th in the nation for childhood education. I'm curious what it's like to juggle news like that while you're trying to relaunch the DPS.
Well, we know we're struggling. I think if you go out and visit the classrooms around the state of Michigan, there are a lot of great things happening, a lot of wonderful opportunities for students in career tech education and five-year college programs. There's just a lot of great things going on. But as a state, we're not performing where we need to be, and that's why we've spent this past year coming up with a vision to become a top 10 state over the next 10 years. And to do that, we need the business community, the parents, educators, all working together with a kind of a single vision and kind of create a cohesive, coherent system and not this constant changing. So we're heading in the right directions, and, you know, we'll get to be a top 10 state by all working together and really changing what we're doing in the classroom to deeper learning, problem solving, working together in teams, working together individually as students, and really create high expectations for what students can achieve and put them in charge of their education by letting them set academic and personal goals and have them be responsible for their improvement. And I think doing those things, working together, will become a top 10 state.
If you were to, if I were to ask you to identify a couple of particular concerns that you have involving the implementation of the new Detroit Public Schools, what would they be?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, we were hoping for kind of a commission to overlook the opening, closing, and siting of schools. We didn't get that, but we've got some other tools we can use to try to have those conversations to make sure that every neighborhood has access to a high-quality school and not have another neighborhood have three or four choices. You know, we have to manage this better. That's not to take away a choice, because we believe parents and students should have choices whether they go to a traditional school, a private school, a charter school, or any other options online. But we want to make sure all those options are of high quality and that are done in a way that each neighborhood is protected to have, you know, quality options in it.
Well, you're referring to the omission of a proposed Detroit Education Commission that would regulate the openings and closings of these schools. Given that omission, go a little bit deeper with us, please. How do you see that being regulated?
Well, I think the SRO, the School Reform Office, has some authority in terms of closing schools that are performing in the bottom 5% in the state.
This is a state of Michigan office.
Yes, we're working through the governor's office. And, you know, we're certainly going to work with the SRO to make sure that schools hopefully are improving and get out of the bottom 5% and get in the top 25%. But if not, then we have to manage that in a way to make sure parents still have choices. But, of course, we want them to have quality choices. So that's one option. Number two, there is going to be still opportunities legislatively to continue the conversation on a DEC type of concept. And it doesn't have to be exactly that way. I think you get good people in a room, even three people who support charters, three people who support traditional, and have a conversation about what's best for kids. I think we can get the job done.
We're talking with State School Superintendent Brian Whiston here on WKAR's Current State. There's a public budget hearing regarding DPS scheduled for today, I take it. What's the purpose of that gathering?
So their budget proposal that Judge Rhodes and his team has put together to look at next school year, he's taking that out on the road and sharing that with people to get their input and share what's going into the budget in terms of revenue and then how to spend the money and to get public input into that. So I think that's a very positive thing the judge is doing. And, you know, we need to start this district off debt-free and help it remain that way. So the budget process, the number of students going to the school, and making sure the revenue lines up is very, very important as we get this fresh start.
That $617 million, that was the sum total that was assigned to this project that got signed into law here. There are some number of critics who fear that that's not enough to solve the district's funding challenges, and it's inevitable that another kind of state rescue is in store. How do you respond to people with that fear?
Well, I think, you know, the Department of Treasury, Department of Education, and the Detroit schools have gone through a very thorough look at what are the debts, both in terms of long-term payables, and I think our number is pretty close. You know, you have interest and other things that can change those numbers, and so we have to watch it very carefully. But I think the process is in place to get the debt paid off, and you know, certainly I don't think there's much of an appetite to go back to the well and put additional dollars there. So we've got to take care of the dollars the state has given us and make sure we do our job to keep the district debt-free and moving forward.
The new plan has relaxed standards. I think that's an accurate word to use. Relaxed standards for teacher certifications here. So non-certified teachers will be able to teach in the city of Detroit, I take it. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think the research is very clear that a high qualified teacher makes a big difference in terms of performance of students. Now, with that said, I do think we need to have some alternative pathways for people who have been successful in the business community and who have passion for educating kids, that they could take the knowledge they have in the business world, say an engineer in math, and who has passion for kids. I think we can get them to become a teacher in a very, you know, a streamlined process, but get them the training they need to deal with the kids, the different instructional techniques, behavior. You know, a lot of people think you can just walk into the classroom and those 30 kids are sitting there all ready to learn and don't have issues. And, of course, the reality is some kids haven't eaten. Some kids are worried about where they're going to sleep tonight. There's a lot of social and emotional issues that we deal with as teachers. And, you know, it's not as easy to teach as people think. But with that said, you know, we do want people who have a passion for kids, who have expertise in life and in the business community to come in and be teachers. And we think we can streamline that process in a way that gets them in the classroom sooner. And then if they're getting the job done, that can help work towards their degree. But I don't think we can just take anyone off the street and say, oh, you want to be a teacher, and that they can walk into a classroom and be successful. It's, you know, the profession of being a teacher is a very noble job, a very difficult job. I mean, you're kind of a nurse, you're a social worker, you're a doctor, you're an educator. There's a lot of different roles you play, and to be successful, you have to play all those roles well. So while I don't support having teachers who are uncertified in the classroom, I do support, you know, a streamlined process to get people who have a passion for kids and a knowledge base to get into the classroom and teach on a quicker basis.
I'd like to get your thoughts on what impact the new plan will have on teachers' unions. I know the measure includes language cracking down on teacher sick-outs. Those created a lot of tension and dispute here the first part of the year. How do you feel the teachers' unions teaching in Detroit classrooms are going to respond to this plan?
Well, I think, you know, I want to be very clear, I'm against teacher strikes. I'm for students, and having students in the classroom is very important. And to have teachers to go out on strike means kids are not getting fed in the classrooms. They're not getting the education they so richly deserve and need. So I'm opposed to teacher strikes and support tightening up legislation that makes it clear that teachers aren't supposed to strike. On the other hand, I understand the frustration of teachers, some of the facilities that they were working in and the conditions of those, and not having textbooks, not, you know, having supplies they need to help their students be successful. I understand that they're very frustrated and you know, they want to do what's best for the kids in their classroom, and they didn't feel like anyone was listening to them. And so I guess I can, on one hand, understand that frustration, but we have to find other ways to get that message across, because we need teachers in the classroom. So many of the Detroit kids are fed through breakfast and lunch programs in the school. So if they're not in school, sometimes that means some kids aren't eating, and we can't have that. And, you know, we all know that the students in Detroit are not performing where we want them to. And so any missed days is not acceptable. So, you know, it's a tough issue, and it's frustrating to teachers. But, you know, we all became educators to work with the kids in the classrooms, and that's where we need to be.
We have so many other questions here that I'm going to have to leave unsaid, unfortunately. We'd like to have you back again soon, Mr. Whiston. We've been speaking with State Superintendent Brian Whiston about the DPS bill and other education issues here in Michigan. Thank you, sir. Good luck.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This weekend, music makers from all over will be converging on the Kent County Fairgrounds. It's the 21st annual Junegrass Bluegrass Festival with some top-level national talent and some local favorites converging in Lowell, about 50 miles west of Lansing. Earlier this week, Current State's Jamie Paisley caught up with Lee Strasberger, organizer and president of the West Michigan Bluegrass Music Association, about the event. Turns out Mr. Strasberger had a bit of a surprise earlier this week.
Yesterday morning at 6:30, I drove through the fairgrounds, and there's already 11 campers in there already for the festival.
Now, I know this is the 21st annual June Grass Bluegrass Festival. Have you been kind of heading it up for all 21 years?
No, I've been president of the association now for 4 years, but I've been with the organization for 7 years, so I've been working on this festival for the last 7 years. The big name groups that we have is Newtown, which is a band that is run by Katie Penn and Junior Williams, and they have a brand new CD that's coming out on July 4th, so they're promoting their new CD. We had them with us about 3 years ago. They reorganized the band, and they sound better than ever, so we're pretty excited about having them. And then our other main headliner is Flat Lonesome, which has probably one of the top-selling CDs on the bluegrass market today called A Runaway Train. So we're excited about being able to get them to be our headliner band for Junegrass.
Yeah.
Then we have a number of local bands as well. Ones that may be familiar with in this area is Out of the Blue. We have Calabogie Road playing. We have New County Grass playing out of the Detroit area. So we have some pretty hot bluegrass bands coming.
Oh, my darling, go and stay if you want it that way. You don't love me, and that is plain to see. If your new love turns you down, I won't be hanging around. So don't you come running back to me. Darling, go and stay if you want it that way. You don't love me, and that is plain to see. If your new love turns you down, I won't be hanging around. So don't you come running back to me.
Now, tell me about Band Scramble. I'm assuming that's not, you know, morning breakfast, you're making eggs for everybody. What is Band Scramble?
Yeah, the Band Scramble is one of the things that everybody looks for. You sign up for it by putting your name on a piece of paper with what instrument you play, and that name gets put into a hat. And then we draw those names out, and whatever three or four people or five people we pull out to be in your band, that is your band that you have to come up with 3 to 4 songs to do in an hour. So they get 1 hour to practice with 3 or 4 people that you've probably never played with before. But now you're going to get together and go on stage and perform 3 or 4 songs for us. And then we will judge the winners.
We're speaking with Lee Strasberger of the West Michigan Bluegrass Music Association about this weekend's 21st annual Junegrass Bluegrass Festival. And Lee, that begs the question then, what is your instrument?
My instrument is a guitar. I've been playing the guitar probably for 55 years, and I have a vintage 1969 Martin D18 that I bought when I was back in college, and I still have it today.
And I won't ask how many years ago that was.
It's been a while.
In addition to, you know, the headliners that you've got Saturday and musicians also coming on Friday, you also have workshops for instrument performing, banjo and fiddle, mandolin, guitar workshops as well, right?
That's correct. We do that on Saturday morning, And then we actually have an organized lesson program where people come in and you can sit there and talk with an instrument player and ask them, well, how do you do this? Or, you know, what do you recommend? How do you do it? This, you know, how do you play it? And so on and so forth. So you can really get some personal instruction of those because they're usually small groups and it's a really a one-on-one almost situation. So it works out really well. But what's nice about it, too, you know, being in the campground, you can easily walk around and see somebody picking at their campsite and just walk up to them and start talking to them and picking with them and learn something new.
Yeah. Which happens, of course, because a lot of this is an overnight as well. Like you said, it's a camping experience. But the question is, if people come and they bring their families and their little ones that maybe not don't have the attention span for all of that music, what are there accommodations that you make for kids?
Yeah, we are bringing Fiddlin' Dixie Joe from the UP is coming down with her kids program. She has a kids corner, and she teaches kids how to make instruments and play different musical games. She does an instrument museum for them, so they can go up and actually handle the instruments and fool around with them. So we're pretty excited about all the different activities that she does for kids. So we're looking forward to that. It should be quite an adventure if you have any children that you're bringing along.
The main events happen Friday and Saturday, 24th and 25th of June. But you said that there are people already camping out there, and the first schedule event doesn't happen until Thursday. What happens Thursday at June Grass?
Yep, everybody that is, you know, comes in before Thursday is invited to come to a potluck. We have a potluck dinner at 5 o'clock on Thursday evening. We have a number of door prizes and things like that that we give away. And it's a good time because again you're seeing the people that you haven't seen since a year ago, and they come back, and so it's a good lot of fellowship going on during that potluck meal. And then we're trying to promote the city of Lowell has a concert series on Thursday nights that start at 7, so we invite our people that are here for our festival to stop by and see the Lowell Sizzle and Summer Series and listen to a band that they have playing on Thursday night.
You're the one, you're the one that made me cry. Oh, you're the one that laughed at me and then said goodbye. Oh, you're the one, you're the one.
Now, this is, after all, summer, and weather can be a question. What are there plans set in place if inclement weather happens for the Kent County Fairgrounds?
We have, we have all this activity under a big tent and a stage outside, but there are also shelters all around the tent that have bleachers and so on, where you can sit under a roof or you can be out of the rain if we do get rain problems under the tent. We also have, we give everybody information about emergency situations like bad weather or if there's any type of medical information. All that information is given in our program so everybody knows what to do in case there's any issues.
We've been speaking with Lee Strasburger, the guitarist and president of the West Michigan Bluegrass Music Association, putting on the 21st annual June Grass Bluegrass Festival at the Kent County Fairgrounds in Lowell, Michigan. More information about the June Grass Festival is available online at wmbma.org. Lee, thanks very much for speaking with us, and I hope you have a picking good time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This is probably the highlight of the year, usually our June Grass Festival is.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And we imagine you'll enjoy this flat, lonesome cover of the Game of Thrones theme to end the show here today. Game of Thrones meets bluegrass. Tomorrow here on Current State, bipartisan criminal justice reform measures are making their way through the Michigan legislature. The Michigan Senate recently approved just such a package of measures. We will speak with the leader of the effort, State Senator John Prose, tomorrow here on Current State. Plus, Corey Kendrick and his jazz trio perform live in Studio S. Corey's played piano with artists like Rodney Whittaker and Etienne Charles. The group's put out a CD called Rootless. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our program's executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast will keep you up to date, informed. It's your indispensable high-tech connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you on Live Music Friday here on WKAR's Current State.